Pod on the Tyne is brought to you by Bet365, the world's favourite online betting company. By downloading the Bet365 app, you can access both pre-match and in-play markets, along with instant match updates for all games. The Bet365 Bet Builder also allows you to make personalised bets via the app, so you can bet on multiple scenarios and create your own bet with unique odds right there in your hands. Bet365 is the world's favourite online sports betting company. The app can be downloaded from Google Play and the Apple App Store. Over 18s only, please gamble responsibly.
Hello and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, a podcast brought to you by The Athletic about all things Newcastle United. Slightly later in the week this week, but we're still here.
Hang on.
What?
I've been away for 2 weeks and someone's died and made you God. Why are you introducing this podcast? I am the senior partner. You're just a strange bloke who loves sausages. What is going on?
Would you like to introduce the podcast, George? Is that what this is all about?
Yes, I'm Batman and you're Robin. In fact, you're the Joker. You are a Joker. That's what you are. You're a Joker.
Well, I'm going to leave this over to you then. I'm going to leave this over to you. You introduce.
Who said that you were the person to do this?
Well, I just took that upon myself. I just thought, you know, I'm going to take some initiative here.
You're like all the other ones in Take That. I'm Robbie Williams. I should be doing this. Come on, this could be my time. If I'd given this some thought, I could make this quite good.
Right, well, fine. I will shut up for a minute then. You go on. You introduce. We'll just have to scrap what I've just said.
Well, I haven't even thought about it.
Hello and welcome to Pod on the Tyne. Slightly later in the week this week, but George Culkin is back with us, but Taylor is not here with us this week, so George and I will be taking us through the show. We will have a special guest in Andy Jones on later. He is our Burnley correspondent to talk about Jeff Hendrick, who's signing a free transfer. But first of all, George, how are we?
Well, I'm slightly pissed off, if I'm being honest, but apart from that, I'm all right. Yeah, I've been away for a little bit. I've very much enjoyed listening to the two podcasts whilst I was away. So well done with that. And now, yeah, well, we're all gearing ourselves up for the new season, aren't we? Come on, we cannot wait for this. It's going to be great. It's going to be brilliant. It's going to be a festival of frivolity and footballing wonderfulness.
I know you're eager to talk about this, George, but that is later in the show that we will get into that real enthusiasm about how excited everyone is about the new season. In terms of a little time away for you, did it help you refresh?
The best thing was deleting Twitter off both my phone and all my devices and things like that, which was quite strange at first, because I do find that you sort of walk into a shop and the first thing you do is look at Twitter, or you go and sit down and look at Twitter. So I was kind of pulling my phone out and then just sort of questioning the entire meaning of life, because it's like, what do I do next? Oh, well, I suppose I better buy something in the shop or whatever. But no, it was good, very good to refresh and to come back to find that, Newcastle have made a signing for one thing, so hooray for that. And they also have some injury problems. So not really, in that sense, not a lot has changed.
No, it hasn't changed very much at all. I mean, the two injury problems that they have at the minute. We don't know quite the extent of Dwight Gayle's injury. It has been reported elsewhere a matter of months rather than weeks. Now, that is my understanding as well. I think it is going to be a little while before Gayle's back. Dubravka is the other one. He's out for about 6 to 8 weeks, it looks like, with a heel injury. But George, first, Gayle, I mean, Newcastle don't exactly have tons of striking options. Everyone already knew they needed to sign a striker this summer. That was clearly going to be the priority regardless. They haven't yet been able to do that. And now they seem to be down to only Andy Carroll as an out-and-out centre-forward right now.
Yeah, I mean, again, the irony, I mean, I had a very brief chat with Steve Bruce at the start of the week just for a little catch-up, and he's kind of said, you know, the key to this season is going to be keeping players fit simply because of the volume of games and the lack of recovery time. And he kind of said, touch wood, that Newcastle were in a good place, that apart from Fabian Scher, who's out for another 6 weeks or so with his dislocated shoulder, that they were looking okay. And so, yeah, that is an immediate setback to that. Dubravka is obviously a really important player, and we know how important he's been over the last couple of years. I'm sort of less immediately bothered by that than I am by the Dwight Gale scenario, simply because, you know, as you have said repeatedly, that position is such a key one for Newcastle this season. Gale, a player that the club have tried to kind of get sell over the past 2 or 3 years, suddenly came back into the team last season and was absolutely pivotal because Joelinton is their £400 million. Wow, I've inflated.
It wasn't quite that much. I mean, it was a lot of money, but I think it was maybe if you take a decimal point back there, I think.
Okay, I'll do that. Maths were never my strong point. They're £40 million sort of millstone. And as you say, Carroll not fit and the other options just not figuring. Gale became really important. They do need a striker. They desperately need a striker and they need a good striker. They need somebody who can come in, who is ready made and can lead the line. So yeah, I am concerned about that one.
Seems to be that the plan before anyway was Yoshinori Muto could be moved on. Joelinton hasn't been seen at the training ground yet or at the training camp, and there's been no official confirmation. Well, you could argue he's missing for most of last season, and I'm sure a lot of Newcastle fans would.
No, that was the joke. That was a joke I was doing.
I got that.
He specialises in missing. That was a joke I was doing.
So anyway, the fact that, yes, they need a striker. Callum Wilson has repeatedly been linked. Now, he is definitely a player that Newcastle United like. Whether they can actually afford him and whether they can afford some of the other players that they like is basically the problem this window. Now, it seems that what's going on behind the scenes in terms of, because they're also looking at a left-back, being linked to various left-backs. I think that basically Steve Bruce and the Newcastle hierarchy are trying to work out how they can best make his budget fit, because his budget is, as we understand it, sort of between 30 and 35 million, maybe significantly reduced on what it was before. And the large proportion of that, if they're going to sign someone permanently, is going to need to go on a centre forward. And it needs to be someone who scores goals. They got away with it to a large extent last season, not having that striker. As far as we're aware, they aren't necessarily close to signing anyone. I do think that the last 24, 48 hours in Dwight Gale's injury has focused minds a little bit. But with the season just 2 and a bit weeks away, it's a little bit alarming that Andy Carroll, albeit given the very good goal he scored against Crewe the other day, is seemingly the only option, because not only is the durability over a season concerning, but we don't even know whether he can last 90 minutes yet, do we?
No, but I mean, I'm sure that Lionel Messi is just around the corner. I'm sure that's the big news that I'm quite surprised no one's put that link together yet, but you know, it'd be nice to see him tip up at St James's, wouldn't it?
Pod on the Tyne is brought to you by Manscaped, the expert in men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels, and Manscaped has just launched in the UK. Their third-generation trimmer features a cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce manscaping accidents, and the water-resistant technology also allows you to groom whilst in the shower. And we've got a special offer right now for all of you listening to this podcast. Get 20% off and free shipping by using the code EPL20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com by using the code EPL20. Happy shaving.
Have you had manscaping accidents, Chris?
Not recently.
So during lockdown, you did cut your own hair, didn't you?
I did, yes, I did. That was very much on my head rather than on another part of my body.
No, but I think if you'd had Manscaped's life-changing products to hand, you would have been less likely to have done that.
You think I would use them on my head as well as on my other parts of my body?
Well, I don't know. I tend to think that men probably use their own facial razors on their downstairs bits. I think if they're going to do that, that's what they would do. I don't think that's very sensible, because you'll probably blunt your razors. But I wonder whether you could use Manscaped's life-changing products on one's head as opposed to one's testicles.
Well, it's something I can try next time I need a lockdown haircut.
Well, I love the fact you've had to read this ad out, because you are so uncomfortable doing it.
That's very true. Right, well, thanks. We're joined on the show by our Burnley correspondent, Andy Jones. Andy, thanks for coming on.
Hello, thanks for having me.
We're here to talk about Jeff Hendricks. So Newcastle United have actually made a signing. I wouldn't say there's that much excitement around it. For someone who's watched a lot of Jeff Hendricks, certainly last season, can you explain the type of player that Newcastle have signed, please?
There's two ways to sort of look at it. In the first is that, you know, I think Jeff Hendricks is going to come in at Newcastle and probably play central midfield, and it's something he's not done for Burnley for sort of the last three seasons. But at the same time, what you can see from his performances and from watching him this year is he is that working light type player. He's neat and tidy on the ball, definitely, and I think that's something you want in your midfielders. He's box to box, I'd say, as a central midfielder. He has got a really good engine on him, and something that Sean Dyche really liked about him. The way I would assume he'll fit into Newcastle's system would be a more reserved role, further back. But also he has played the number 10 for Burnley. He can nip play together, linked up well with, whoever Burnley were playing as the front man, and sort of knitted things together and sort of just, keep, as a level-headed type player, just sort of keeps everything ticking along, really.
So there are a couple of things that I wanted to say about Hendrick. Firstly, that Newcastle did actually try to sign him in 2016, and at that point they couldn't afford him, there is a sort of level of irony about that, I think, that they were outbid by Burnley. The second thing is that I saw a lot of him at Euro 2016 because I covered Ireland at the time and I saw all his matches there. And that was the sort of tournament really when he established himself in that squad, along with Robbie Brady, who also ended up at Burnley. And I think at that moment, it was like he drove the team. He was one of the driving forces in the team. Now, what I would say is that, having seen him play for Ireland since then, is that he never quite recaptured that, or he never quite kicked on. Now, admittedly, he was playing in a very, very poor team, which should probably serve as some sort of preparation for what's going to happen next. But he didn't, we did get the kind of feeling that he didn't sort of kick on for Ireland. Do you think he's developed as a player during his time at Burnley?
I think it's a fair comment that he's probably not necessarily kicked on as much as maybe he could have. But I think that is, it's partly due to the way where he's played for Burnley, because he's in a way, I think it's sort of a square peg in a round hole. I think Burnley fans sort of use that phrase quite a lot when it comes to Jeff Hendrick. He's not a right midfielder, and he's not necessarily the most comfortable playing there, but what he does and what you can guarantee is that he's going to give you everything, and it's why Dyche wanted to keep him and really liked him, because he and Dyche used this quote towards the start of the season. He said something along the lines of he always finds a way back into the team, and that's a testament to him and what must be his work on the training ground to continue to make the noises and keep knocking on the door, essentially. But I think it's a difficult one to judge because he's not played central midfield for a long time. I think potentially he could have kicked on more than he has, but that is dependent on circumstances, I would say.
I mean, Andy, you and I worked on this piece sort of looking at Hendrick and what Newcastle are signing, where he may fit in. And it was interesting because we did this sort of analysis looking at the last few years. And as you hinted at, he didn't play central midfield that much the last couple of seasons. He did to begin with at Burnley. I mean, he will come in at Newcastle and he gives them options. He will be able to compete with Isaac Hayden and Jonjo Shelvey for that midfield berth. If it's 4-2-3-1, he could also play a little bit further forward. It gives him the option of moving to a sort of three-man midfield. That versatility, it's sort of that cliche that someone that comes with a utility man, that it gets them more game time, but at the same time, it can be a hindrance to them because they don't settle on a position. I mean, you said before that Sean Dyche really liked him and didn't want to lose him. That's something which I don't think has necessarily been highlighted enough on this. He's gone on a free transfer. That's because his contract was up. It wasn't because Burnley wanted to lose him, was it? Dyche wanted to keep him, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And I think that's a testament to Hendrick and, his professionalism. But yeah, he will come in and give Newcastle options, and he certainly will, stake his claim. You're right, the versatility tag can work against players because you can be shoehorned into, positions that you aren't quite comfortable with, and sort of the way Jeff Hendrick's Burnley career developed, you can sort of see that. But I think what that has helped him do, and in terms of, just referring to the last question as well, in terms of that development and kicking on, is his technical awareness has definitely improved because he's learning different positions. And Burnley's midfield is very difficult to play because you're usually outnumbered in the sort of 3v2 against most midfields. The versatility of playing as a 10, as a wide man and in the centre has been beneficial in the tactical sense because he's learned a lot of roles and learned, positioning and where he needs to be and when to go forward, when to make sure he's on the cover. And I think that all, sort of helps as you develop and progress in your career and as you get older and sort of mature.
Well, really, thank you very much for that insight, Andy. It's been great to have you on. And I mean, that article that Andy and I worked on, you can read that on The Athletic at the moment. There's still a 30-day free trial if you haven't signed up. So it's theathletic.com/NewcastlePod, and you'll be able to find all the Newcastle United stuff and Burnley stuff there if you want to look back at Hendrick's time there too. Well, it was good to get that insight from Andy Jones. I know that there hasn't been too much excitement about Jeff Hendrick necessarily, although I do think people accept that it is a decent signing given the circumstances. A few weeks ago, obviously, I think there was maybe loftier ambitions from a lot of Newcastle fans and even certainly those who were trying to buy the club about who may be arriving this summer. But this is the situation Newcastle are in, that takeover has stalled, collapsed, however you want to put it. And right now, Jeff Hendrick signing is certainly better than nothing for Newcastle United.
Yeah, and I did on that subject, must we? Do we have to? I would like to sort of just take a step back and pay tribute to Newcastle fans, and in particular to the Newcastle United Supporters Trust for their efforts. On the day before I had my time off, I was very pleased to be asked to host a town hall meeting that the Trust had, really sort of talking about what happened next and talking about sort of that transparency from the Premier League. But I think to get 80 MPs to respond to their request for transparency from the Premier League, to get Boris Johnson involved, to get over half an hour with Richard Masters at Premier League is a real achievement, and to get the depth of answers that they got too. I do want to make that point that is the power that football fans can have if they work together. And you know, I just think that's an achievement that I want to recognise on the pod and say well done to Alex at the Trust, a friend of ours, and you know, for everything he's done. Now I know that sort of after that there might be this thought of, you know, well, you know, what was the point of all that then? What's really changed? Well, what's really changed is you've got the Premier League answering questions in great detail and saying, you know, actually saying that in future, the owner and director's test may have to change, and that there should be a way of keeping supporters involved. And I think that's quite a big deal. And I think that, you know, I do. And again, I've seen that there's been, you know, it's then kind of been thrown back onto Amanda Staveley's consortium, that they sort of have questions to answer. But I mean, I think from that perspective, what I would say is, I think, what we talked about before I went away, that it has moved into a different sphere. I think it's moved into the political sphere now, the takeover, how you have all sides still, in inverted commas, committed to it, but not actively taking part in the director's test. It has gone to a political sphere, and I think that's where it'll stay. So I don't expect there to be particularly any more public comment. I think what happens, there's been not too much public comment, but there's been too much sort of just a public unpicking of what's happening. If anything's going to happen, good or bad, it needs to happen in private from now on. But to repeat, I think what the Trust did and what Newcastle United fans did was pretty remarkable.
I would echo all of that, though. Although I would agree that we probably do need silence to an extent from the consortium, if that's going to be picked up, then really that needs to all be done in private, whether it's going to be a positive or negative conclusion in the end. But the one group who I do think that we need to hear more from, certainly going up to the new season, was sort of made the point repeatedly by the Premier League themselves, actually was interesting. They said throughout the takeover process, Newcastle United could have communicated more, and it was their decision to a large extent that a lot of the information wasn't relayed, because if you remember correctly, that all communication between the prospective buyers and the Premier League goes through the club. So they were kept informed, certainly at the highest level, throughout. Now, in terms of, I don't mean that we need the club to come out and say that this takeover's on, this takeover's necessarily off, but just to give fans some sort of direction going into the new season. We had a statement from Lee Charnley to Sky Sports a few weeks ago. It was a very brief statement saying that they're backing Steve Bruce. We haven't quite yet seen that, and it would be nice to know just that there is some sort of, at least, medium to short term, short to medium term plan for what's going to happen with Newcastle United? Because at the minute, as we're going to discuss it in a second, I think there's a lack of optimism, isn't there, George, around the club in terms of around the fans at the minute.
Well, and you can absolutely understand that, can't you? I mean, it does. You know, it feels like we have this kind of conversation every summer, really. And that's the sad, you know, that's the sad thing. Obviously, last summer, a year ago, or a year and a bit ago, the mood around the club felt very deflated and pretty toxic. And, you know, it feels the same thing now, that we keep having these huge spikes of hope. You know, we have these spikes of hope, and then we have the massive fall afterwards. And that certainly happened again. We are living in this kind of quite strange parallel universe, of course, now, when, you know, the football's going to be played in front of an empty stadium. So we don't know, you know, we don't know what the kind of physical effect of what's happened this summer will be on the club, you know, whether it would have a sort of massive implication in terms of the numbers turning up. But, you know, to repeat a very, you know, a very old fact, we know that 10,000 people didn't turn up last season, and that the club filled the ground with free part season tickets. It does feel very deflated because what would have, you know, because of what might have been. And so that's the backdrop that the club are operating in. And yeah, I mean, you put a poll on Twitter the other day, didn't you, just to sort of try and get a gauge of mood. And I mean, the response from the Newcastle jury was pretty overwhelming.
So we had 6,027 responses. Actually, this is me scratching George's back to a certain degree, because he is doing a piece about hope, which I don't know when exactly that's going to come out, but that's about all clubs. But I sort of put out the Newcastle United side asking, do fans feel optimistic or pessimistic? There was four options on this poll, which was up for 24 hours on Twitter. So there was top 10, and we got 2%, mid-table, 6%, struggle but survive, 44%, big trouble, 48%. Now, we didn't even necessarily explain what big trouble is, but I suppose the implication is that a lot of people are fearing relegation this season.
Yes, I mean, that is a pretty... Now, I said I wasn't very good at maths, so that's what, 92% people predicting big trouble or struggle. And that, I mean, it does feel like a fairly reflective... you know, these things are never quite scientific. But I mean, you've got 6,000 responses, which is amazing. Thank you very much for that. And that is a particularly bleak set of numbers. I can't imagine that any other club would have such a bleak response. I mean, I just don't. And I mean, the 2% saying top 10, that's quite interesting. And no, so it doesn't feel, that's not the most uplifting way to start the season, but I do think it's reflective. That could change, of course, because there've only been a kind of couple of free transfers, Jeff Hendrick, as you mentioned before, and a third choice goalkeeper. So they will, you know, they will have to do more before the season starts. But that poll very much suggests that we're going to be looking for three worse signs again.
There were, I mean, I sort of invited further comments below, and a lot of the explanations were basically about that. There's quite a few people who said that their response may be different if a striker signs, or if they do make significant signings really in the course of the next few weeks. But there's a lot of people basically just saying that they have very little faith in the current setup, and the fact that they feel that, as seemingly has been the case, that Mike Ashley is all but moved on, other than in the fact that he hasn't been able to, because the takeover hasn't actually happened. We've also had the release of the fixtures, so this was post that, and I have to say it was the least enthusiasm I've ever seen for the release of the fixtures. I think that's across the board. I don't think that was just Newcastle United. That's possibly just because the last season was only a few weeks ago, but certainly in a Newcastle United sense, I suppose. That poll probably shows that there is very little optimism, and really people aren't that excited about a comeback. Obviously, fans won't be there to begin with, but it's West Ham away on the opening day of the season. So not the worst start to the season for Newcastle United, but the Christmas period looks very, very, very difficult. They have Man City, Liverpool and Leicester in the space of a few days. The run-in's also very difficult. I mean, George, when you saw the fixtures, I know we have to play everyone at some point across the course of the season. I know that's what it is. But when you saw them, what was your immediate reaction to the fixtures?
Well, I was on holiday, so I really could not have given any less of a toss.
Well, now that you've seen them.
I mean, I really couldn't give any less of a toss. It feels like, I might be making this up, but it feels like for the last sort of couple of seasons, they've been really tough starts, haven't they? Am I right in saying that? Yeah. And so it feels slightly more gentle than that. But I mean, so I am of that school of thought that says Newcastle play everybody twice, so just get on with it. But I'm also the kind of person who just looks at any list of fixtures and thinks, yeah, we'll lose that, we'll lose that, we'll lose that, we'll lose that, and then we're in crisis. So I do that no matter who they're going to play. So I kind of tend to think that no matter what. Christmas does look sort of tricky, and certainly the end looks tricky. I mean, I think that's more, you know, that would be more the worry for me. Except that, again, over the last three seasons, Newcastle, well, certainly the first two seasons back in the Premier League, it's been the second half of the season when Newcastle have kind of tended to come on strong. And so hopefully that's still, you know, hopefully that's still there. But yeah, I think it's more the sense for me is, oh my God, we have to start this all over again. That was my sort of reaction to the fixture list, as opposed to sort of looking at clumps of fixtures and thinking that Newcastle will win or lose. I'm so old and so cynical that I just think Newcastle will lose every game.
Well, I sympathise with Bruce to a certain extent, but I also think he's on a sort of hiding nothing. I mean, he said that he wants to progress the club and take them forward, and yet it seems like we're going to have the inevitable conversation throughout certainly the first few weeks and months of the 2020-21 season, saying, can Newcastle get to 40 points as quickly as possible? And that is the frustration, and I think that's a lot of what fans are looking at with this poll, and when they talk about the direction of the club, is that just seems to be a yearly occurrence. Now, I know you could argue that 10 to 12 Premier League clubs are also in that position, but it's just the fact that Newcastle don't seem to ever move forward. There doesn't seem to be that strength in early, even if they do make signs between now and the end of the season. And I know that most clubs, Chelsea aside, haven't done that much business either yet, but they're going to waste potentially a first few games of the season not having had new additions in place immediately for the start of pre-season, so that they can be up to scratch. And that is going to be a challenge for Steve Bruce, isn't it, to really make sure that the first game of the season, the squad that he has at his disposal is ready, because Newcastle really need to start well if there's going to be any sort of positive momentum they can generate.
Yeah, and, you know, of course he wants to progress the club, and, you know, he means that. It's not just words. He hasn't come to St. James's Park to just, you know, to see out his time and just tick over. That's not what he wants. I mean, you know, fans might have their perception of him as a manager, but, you know, that's not what he's about. That there are so many challenges at the club, and, you know, there have been for such a long time now. They have not historically been quick off the mark when it comes to signings. That was something that Benitez was, always tearing his hair out. Not, you know, that they could identify players, but it was actually getting them into the building that proved problematic. And, you know, we've mentioned a couple of players that Newcastle might be interested in. Well, they're not going to get involved in an auction and pay over the odds. The other, you know, so that's part of the history. As you mentioned, the circumstances now are just how much has Mike Ashley checked out of the building. I mean, he's been an absentee landlord for a long time now, and getting him engaged and getting him interested. I mean, he got interested and engaged about Jolinton, and that didn't work out very well. So I'm not saying that's the key to it. But, you know, at a time when funds are going to be sort of harder to come by, does him checking out emotionally have an effect on the team, on the club? And then there's the sort of stuff that you just can't measure. I mean, I would always think that there is a judge and jury at Newcastle, just that there is at every club, and that is inside a stadium on a Saturday. And we haven't got that. You know, obviously we didn't have that towards the end of last season. And now moving forward, we're not going to have it again. So Newcastle are going to be playing in this vacuum. You've got this club that has been depressed, had that air of depression around it for a long time. It had that huge spike of enthusiasm in sort of April, May about what might happen. That sort of tailed off. The season tailed off. And now it's that kind of sense of, where is the club? What does it stand for? What is it trying to do? What is the plan? Is there a plan? And ostensibly there isn't one. And that's not, you know, that's not to say that Steve Bruce's plan isn't to progress, because of course it is. But what, you know, what does it all mean? And it's that strange sort of, we're going to have that strange sort of thing where, you know, you always expect the promoted clubs to come up with sort of big motivation and momentum behind them, and other clubs doing their own thing. And it just feels like, it kind of feels like Newcastle are traipsing along. That's not, that's definitely not Steve Bruce's fault, but it's something that he's going to have to deal with.
It does feel that way. And I was going to say that we're going to finish the podcast with a slightly more upbeat topic, but I don't know whether you could necessarily say it is more upbeat. In some senses, I would say that it probably is, but I think it also, if there's a person in terms of it, is it who almost characterises Newcastle United and unfulfilled potential, then that would be Hatem Ben Arfa. And Friday, if this does go out on Friday morning, we have an article going up on The Athletic, George and I, that we've been working on. It's 10 years since Hatem Ben Arfa first signed for Newcastle United. And we've sort of looked back at his time. It wasn't a particularly easy piece to put together, or certainly to write. I mean, to get people to speak about him, they were quite keen, but then it was difficult to get them to sort of explain all the different sides to Hatem Ben Arfa, because George, he was a very, I'd say complex is probably the best way of describing Ben Arfa, the character, the player, the rebel.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the great way of putting him. I mean, you know, if you're talking about most naturally gifted players who've been at Newcastle over my time of watching the team, he would be right up there at the top. In terms of players that I enjoyed watching, however, I'm not sure how close to the top he would be, because there was that just combination of sort of brilliance, but infuriation, that the capability of doing something really special, but also the liability that he would be sometimes giving the ball away, as opposed to finding a simple pass for his teammate, giving the ball away in a dangerous area and the opposition getting the ball and attacking. And as we say in this piece, he also became something else, and he is one of the emblems of the Ashley era. I mean, not in a positive way towards Mike Ashley, but quite the opposite, that somehow he took on this role. He was seen as this kind of vivid, brilliant talent who was being held back by the club. And depending on your viewpoint, he was being held back simply, you know, because Mike Ashley's Newcastle is incapable of progressing. But also there was the narrative around Alan Pardew at the time that he was not a manager who was prepared to work with this difficult, infuriating, but brilliant talent. And he had all this sort of stuff going on at the time. I mean, I interviewed him a couple of times when he was at Newcastle, and he wasn't a straightforward character, and it was quite good to sort of remind myself of that. Equally, I've loved watching, you know, those two very special goals he scored, particularly against Bolton and Blackburn. Have I got that right, Chris?
It is correct, yes.
Thank you. Well done to me. 5 extra points. And, you know, that glimpse of potential. And he's such a sort of divisive character. You know, we talk about the fact that he was on those fan banners, Hope, and the face of Che Guevara, sort of him superimposed on that, and Pardew was hopeless, you know, hope versus hopeless. And really what he did, I'm not sure that what he did was sort of worthy of that role, except that he's kind of done it everywhere. You know, he fell out at both of his French clubs, Lyon and Marseille, before he got to Newcastle. And of course he fell out badly with Pardew and others at Newcastle. And of course, you know, there's a small irony that he then goes on to Hull, where Steve Bruce wanted to, you know, thought he was a gamble worth paying, and he lasted 9 matches on loan, and his last appearance at Hull was 35 minutes. He gets substituted, and Hull's analysts had worked out that he'd run less than the goalkeeper. Absolutely, you know, a proper enigma.
He is, and I think that me and you disagree slightly on him in that, and I'd say that you have the benefit of being really old, because you've seen the likes of Gascoigne, you saw Beardsley at his pomp, and I probably didn't witness them. So for me, in a Newcastle United shirt, just in terms of naturally gifted, I don't think I've seen a player, certainly in the last 20 years, who is as naturally gifted as him. I saw Ginola very early on, and so I wouldn't say he's in the same breath as him in terms of impact, what he could have. But I remember the first time Ben Offa came on against Blackpool, and he just took on his man just at the on the left hand on the right hand side of the penalty area and got past him without really actually doing anything, and I'd never seen a player do it so effortlessly. And he was capable of doing that, and he's frustrating, he's exasperating, he has not fulfilled his potential at all. We spoke to a lot of players who basically said, look, it's no exaggeration to say talent-wise, he could have been mentioned in the breath of, if not quite Messi and Ronaldo, but certainly just below them. But he didn't get anywhere close to that. But I think I'm more sort of pro Ben Arfa being this sort of brilliant footballer than I suppose you were. I accept all of the negatives that go around it, but I think I'm more sympathetic to him than you probably are.
Maybe. I mean, all I've been thinking when you were speaking there was about you talking about how old I am, and so I'm just quaking with fury.
Well, you know.
That goal against Bolton Wanderers, the thing that's sort of amazing, and it is 70 yards, he gets the ball in his own half and just runs forward. The amazing thing about that is that it's a straight line. He runs in a straight line. Now, he reminds me of Gascoigne in that. You made the point in what we write that he's not like Alain Saint-Maximin, for example, who's kind of, you know, he's tricky, flicky, fancy Danny, you know, step overs and does that and you know, has done it brilliantly. But he's not like that. It's the way he runs is he feints and he drops the shoulder and he does things like that, and the ball just sticks to him. And you're right, Gascoigne was the player who really kind of made me fall in love with football, who sort of, you know, I would always sort of describe him as this kind of violent artist who was elbows as well as kind of brilliance, and he had a way of sort of muscling around people, getting through people almost. But Ben Arfa sort of did the same thing, maybe not quite as physical, but the ball would stick to him as he ran forward, and it's the ball just sticks to his feet, and I love that. I fell out with Alan Pardew pretty badly towards the end, but I did get on with him. I got on with him quite well for most of his time at Newcastle. And I suppose I shared that sort of feeling that there has to be some form of discipline. And I'm not talking about discipline, you know, I suppose I wonder what Bobby Robson would have done with him, you know, someone who did have a Bellamy. He was a very difficult character, but he got the best out of him. I suppose I wonder what somebody like Sir Bobby would have done with a Ben Arfa if he could have harnessed him a bit better. But I would just watch him on the pitch, and he would give the ball away in such dangerous positions. And you would see players holding their hands up. You know, at some point, you have to know when to play a simple pass. And that was my sort of big criticism of him, that he just wanted his own football. And when it worked, it was absolutely beautiful to watch. Don't get me wrong, it was absolutely sensational, but it would only work very, very rarely. And the rest of the time, he was putting the team in trouble.
I did used to find it hilarious when he used to have matches where he'd be on the right wing and in front of Pardew, and for whatever half that was, Pardew would shout at him and he'd listen to him. And then as soon as it switched around the other half, he was on the other side of the pitch, and you could just see he just was not paying any attention to Pardew whatsoever. And it was a waste of time for him. But in terms of just that Bolton goal, the thing that makes it for me, and you probably miss it on first viewing, it is that little touch that he does over David Wheater just outside the box. It is absolutely genius, the way that he just flicks it just over him to make sure he can draw the defender and get into the box and score it. And yeah, that is the memory I will have of Hatem Ben Arfa. All of the other stuff I accept and agree with, but I do think the genius just about shines through for me. I think we're going to wrap it up there. We've tried to end on a sort of positive there, because a lot of this podcast has been negative. I suppose a lot of the last 6 months has been negative, in the sense that if we look back at how much of a waste of time it's felt.
45 years.
Yeah. So anyway, let's round up there. We obviously have everything that you can read on The Athletic at the minute, including that Hatem Ben Arfa piece. If you visit theathletic.com/Newcastle Pod, there is a 30-day free trial. We also had an interview with Media Bead on there this week. We've had plenty of other bits for you to look at, including the Jeff Hendrick article we mentioned earlier. And we will be back next week for another episode of Pod on the Tyne.